Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
Tonight, I want to start with a question as we move in tonight. The last couple of weeks are going to be kind of related as we bring things kind of home. But what's your favorite gospel and why? Does anybody have an answer? Does anybody have one to make you pick between your kids? Yeah?
John.
More red words. There we go. That's the good old answer. That's a good answer. Great answer.
Yeah.
Luke. Why Luke?
Yeah.
Very intellectual man. Anybody else want to dissent or throw in lots here with the other two? Yeah. Anybody else have one you want to share? I'm kind of curious.
I like Mark, but it's not just because it's another one that hasn't been chosen, yeah. Right?
But it did work out that way.
But the reality is pretty simple. It's not so much, of course, I enjoy reading it like any of them. But when somebody says to me that's totally a non-Christian, or yeah. I'm just giving them a Bible if they ask, that's what I tell them to go read.
Yep.
Well, just go read this short story about Jesus.
Yeah. Mark is right to the point, right? No Matthew fans, huh? I knew that was going to happen. Yeah, I must confess, too, the genealogy in Matthew was never quite my favorite to get through. I like them all, right? I think we all like them all for different reasons. They all offer something unique. Mark, for his brevity, I do like that. He's right to the point. Luke gives us some intellectual detail. Matthew goes on with genealogy, which, much as I like history, it's tough to read sometimes. But it's important and gives us history. And John's my favorite, too. For a lot of those reasons, and tonight we're going to talk about John a little bit. And before we do that, I want us to turn to the Old Testament. We're going to go back first and quickly look at a couple of things. I've been looking forward to this one, and I think we'll have some discussion about it, but I want to step back a minute to Numbers 32:23. If you want to turn there, we're just going to look at that verse. Your sins will find you out. How many of you ever had that told to you, or maybe you said that, or a relative or grandparent or somebody, your sins will find you out. I remember hearing that so much. Seems like every little thing I did, your sins will find you out. My grandmother used to say that all the time. She was right. But in Numbers 32:23 says, in my translation here, but if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Does anybody else have a different translation there? Any other words or anything different there at all? Pretty straightforward one. Your sins will find you out. Well, think about sin and accusations and how we respond to them. I want us to turn now, if somebody would go to 2 Samuel 12. And if someone could, when you get there, read 2 Samuel 12, 1-6. And I want you to think about the way we as people respond when our sins are pointed out, okay? Because when pointed out, I would say most of us respond differently. People respond very differently in a moment of accusation, right? Regardless of how much we want to think we would act in a situation, a lot of times maybe we've been through that in our heads, say, I know if I was facing this scenario, I would do this, or I wouldn't do that. But I wonder, someone, if you would read 2 Samuel 12, verses 1-6 for me.
Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said to him, there were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb which he had bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and drank of his own cup and lay in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man who refused to take from his own flock, from his own herd, to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him, but he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die, and he shall restore fourfold for the lamb, because he did this thing, and because he had no pity. Then Nathan said to David, you are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would also have given you much more.
All right. So yeah, we see the scene happening here that, you know, David. Okay, so what is Nathan pointing out here to David? What has happened? Sin with Bathsheba. And of course, what do we hear from what do we hear in David or read in these words in David's response in verse 5? What is his immediate response? Anger. David, get him. Bring him in here now. Right? Bring him in. Bring them in. Who is that? Right? And of course, Nathan says, "You are that man. You're that man. It is I who anointed you king, delivered you." Right? You know, there's anger. David, you know, we read about David. We talked about him a little bit in some of the Kings. And outside of this incident, God says, you know, he was a man after God's own heart. You know, he did a lot of great things. But in verses 7 to 12, you know, we see he says, "You were that man. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel." We see down in verse 12, talking about, talks about what the Lord will do. "Behold, I'll raise up evil against you from your own household. I'll take your wives." And goes on and says, you know, "We will do this in the daylight." In verse 13, David responds a little differently after it's told. What is in verse 13? What does verse 13 say that David simply says?
"I have sinned against the Lord."
Yeah, a little contrite now, huh? Kind of been brought low. "I have sinned against the Lord." After it's brought in open, he responds. Now, but, you know, we don't all do that. Sometimes it takes a minute. "I have sinned against the Lord." Coming to that point, though, is an interesting thing. Often, if you've ever been rebuked, you know, I mean, I don't know if you'd agree. I mean, our common reflexive response to being rebuked, what's yours? Be honest. Sometimes maybe I go too much into them. I say, "What did I do? What did I do? Or what did you do? How dare you?" It depends on the person. And sometimes I think we go the other way too far. Sometimes we don't think, what's going on? Anger, we're reflexive. We don't like being called out. If you've ever, anybody teaching here? Like at any level of school, you ever have evaluations or anything for your students? Good gracious, right? But anybody at a work project, you go through evaluations, right? You got to write those up. It's terrible. You hate evaluating yourself. And I don't know about you, but it irks me when you have to sit and listen to somebody tell you about, right? I don't like it. I don't. And I try to learn, you know, sometimes, but sometimes they're right. Not all the time, right? But sometimes they're right. There's always something. But that idea of rebuking and correcting and taking correction is very difficult. It is. It's something to refine and learn, and it's a godly quality that we're going to learn about tonight. Could someone turn to Proverbs 15 for me? And I will get Matthew 7. If somebody could read Proverbs 15, 28 to 32 for me. And I want us to think about what this teaches us about sin and correction. And I want you to think about the one providing correction and the one receiving. Once you have that, Proverbs 15, 28 to 32, if you wouldn't mind reading.
"The heart of the righteous ponders how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things. The Lord is far from the wicked, but he hears the prayer of the righteous. The light of the eyes rejoices the heart, and good news refreshes the bones. The ear that listens to the life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. Whoever ignores instruction despises himself, but he who listens to reproof gains intelligence."
Okay. Matthew 7:1 says, "Do not judge, lest what? You be judged." So what are those two? How do those work together to tell us, though? Are they contradictory? Or how do they work together to tell us how we are to behave in those situations? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, judging in Matthew 7 really means to pass sentence on. It doesn't mean to observe, because he goes on to say just right after that about the false teachers and the wolves in sheep's clothing, and by their works you shall know them. So we can observe, but to pass sentence is wrong.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. That segues nicely. The concept of passing sentence, justice, okay? Anybody else have thoughts on that? Well, and that's exactly, I think, what we need to think about is context. And I left a lot of context out there. You think about John 8:7. We're going to jump to John here in a minute. That famous phrase, right? "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone." Right? There's a few translations. That's our mic drop moment tonight, right? One of them. What a I love this story. I hope you all do too. There's so much here, and I know you got thoughts about it, at least one verse. So I want us to hear your thoughts on what we think is happening here. But this is a troubling verse a lot of times for a lot of theologians and people that maybe question the character of Jesus, question his consistency, question our consistency. Bible says one thing here and another. Does it? Not really. Okay, so that's where we're going to be. And if you'll turn to John 8, we're going to go to John. And we're going to spend some time there tonight and what we have. And go and sin no more in John 8. This idea of one famous story from John 8 that you can probably tell from the images that come from a couple of adaptations. What story are we talking about here? On adultery. I always called it the line in the sand, but of course never really says that, right? It's a pop culture phrase we get now too. That's the line I won't cross. I mean, it has its roots. But this is a great story that I think sometimes we miss a few things. But when you think about the Gospel of John, it's got the most red letters, so we like that. I like that answer too, but what are other purposes or goals? What comes to mind when you think about John? You mentioned we hear Jesus quite a bit. What else? What are the things that come to your mind when you think about the Gospel of John?
It actually talks about love more than any of the other Gospels do.
Talks about love a lot. Gospels do, yeah. That's right. I won't score you on grammar. What else? Talks about love. What do you think of? What are we trying to dig deep and think about? What do we remember from John?
I think the very first verse where it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God.
What's so unique about that? Why does the writer open with that and really dwell on that? What's he wanting us to know? He's there. He is God. It's a complicated verse, especially if you're young. It's complicated for me now. I don't fully understand it all. Not really. I think of a few things. John, looking ahead too, things in the Gospel of John. John 20, 30, we hear of a lot of things happen. We talk about Jesus performing many other signs in the presence of the disciples. John goes on and on to tell us, Jesus did a lot of stuff I'm going to tell you about, and a whole lot more I'm not going to, right? He tells us a couple of times, I want you all to know, you cannot put in a book series. We cannot chronicle. He's trying to really let us know how powerful Jesus is. And his role as Messiah, Son of God, believing you may have life in his name. There's some unique events recorded in the book. It's probably the last gospel written. A lot of debate on that. Written by the disciple Jesus loved. We see that. There's some debate on this too in different circles. Which John 21, 20, 24, though, we see some reference to that, the disciple Jesus loved. The text really wants us to know who Jesus is as divine and sovereign. Liz, you know, that's a good point. He goes out of his way to say, you know, Jesus is sovereign. He is king. In the beginning, he was there. John 1. There are two halves of John, really, when people study it. If you think about it, that's the way I think about it. It's in two halves, right? We have a whole bunch of signs, and we have a section that talks about his glory. John records many miracles in John, if you remember. There's seven major ones. Anybody want to take a credit, see if you can remember any come to mind? Water to wine is recorded. What else? It's not a quiz per se, but I think, what do we think about? Yeah, do you think about water to wine? What are some other ones?
Blind man.
Heals the blind man. Who else? Feeding the 5,000. Lame man at the pool. The pool of Siloam is going to come up later, too. There's another pool. What else?
Thoughts on the water.
Okay. Lazarus, raising from the dead. That's a pretty big one.
Fill the net with fish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good one. So I was thinking of a few too, some of you've already mentioned. Walks on water, heals the blind man, Lazarus, healing a royal official's son, water to wine. A lot of big things, and I just want us to keep that in mind. He makes a lot of big moments here in John. The Book of Glory, kind of we see after the signs, we see the things he does. We see the latter part talking about Jesus' relationship with his disciples. That's important. He wants us to see love, and he sees what his reaction is when he circles the wagon, sort of, and he's really trying to comfort and show what is to come. He withdraws after many disbelieve, we see in John 12. We see a lot of his love when he shows how he comforts his disciples, makes promises, prays. He dies for them, ultimately, right? Rises from the dead. That's important. The story's not over, right? Records his visit with his disciples. We get a lot of details about love. And John wants us to know that Jesus did so much, we can't get them all. So there's a few in John 8, particularly, that I think we can learn a lot of lessons. We can learn about compassion. And I think that's true. But I think we do a disservice sometimes when we almost treat this story like a parable. That makes sense? It's not a parable, right? It's a good story, right? It's easily digestible. In many ways, week one, I told you about that idea of when they'd write these, you know, collect these things, it matches lit of the time literature, those kreas, the Greek kreia. It's a great one-punch setup, right? Jesus has an encounter. It's recorded very eloquently. Boom, 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 story. But it's in the middle of so many other big things that we miss out if we don't look at context. We learn a lot about God's sovereignty, but we learn a lot about mercy and grace, and a little bit about justice too, as Ronnie pointed out, about sentencing and how we respond maybe in those situations. And I would say we need to remember we learn about God as both merciful and just. One does not preclude the other, right? It's no such thing as Old Testament God and New Testament God. A lot of people want to do that so we can say, well, that's the folktale I believe in. No, I believe in God, right? Okay, so let's read, if someone would now, let's get to our text and the time we have. Would someone mind reading John 8, verses 1 to 11 for me?
Each to his own house, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say?" This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones, and Jesus was left alone with a woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more."
Man, that's a powerful statement. And I think this is one we need to hang on every word. The words he chose, that she chose, and not change them out, okay? Because there's a lot going on here with how we, while we misunderstand some things about judging and forgiveness and sentencing and law, that Jesus fully understands. And once again, you do not challenge Jesus in a battle of wits. That's the first lesson, right? We learn this. Do not do that, right? It's not a game, right? There is no competition. There was never a chance of losing, right? Jesus is also not doing this to destroy people, but to teach. However, it doesn't look good when you try to attack Jesus. Now, I want to give a couple notes. We're not going to read these. Well, it's just one verse before, but some of you may know this, but I don't want to introduce a problem that maybe isn't there. But you know, there are a lot of scholars that don't, you may have heard that, that think this passage is made up in terms of biblical literature, that a lot of scholars try to say, well, this one doesn't fit the rest. Well, that's not true, and there's a lot of evidence as to why. But there was a lot of debate about this, and you may figure out why as we talk about this. But this is the Gutenberg Press. I want you to think about once we finally got things printed, you know, back in the 1400s, 1500s, you know, there was oral tradition. We had things passed down. We know that. Things were very well preserved. We know that through other texts, okay? But, you know, this whole section was debated by a lot of folks. This is an example, though, of one of the earliest, just I thought was cool, codices from the Gospel of John. They think it is at least from maybe 90, maybe to 100 AD. This was one of the first codexes, one of the books. So the book guy in me likes that, not a scroll. But we know it's one of the original ones, and it has legible text. They can piece it together. There are other texts we have. You know, since then, centuries passed, and this is from the Tyndale Bible. You've probably read Tyndale commentaries and things like that, and a medieval kind of guy here, but one of the first, when it wasn't till the 1500s, you know, we had kind of our first Bible in English, mass-produced, okay? That is to say, everybody's working off translations and everything, but it's interesting that when it comes to this passage, and Craig Bell made me think of this, because he mentioned in our class, we were talking about how you look at all these translations, and sometimes looking at several at once triangulates to the answer, right? Sometimes you can see, ah, I see, that's what they're saying. But there were several. I'm not trying to just throw a bunch of words out, but you've probably heard these before, seen them. When you see about biblical scholarship, a lot of early translations fought about this passage. Okay, there were early Greek translations called the Sinaiticus, the Alexandrinus, the Vaticanus, which led to the Vatican Catholic Bible, the Ephremi. They were all missing this or moved it somewhere else with a note. And scholars could say, why is it there but with a note? Well, Especially, some of them really pointed it out. One of them called the Didascalia Apostolorum has it, but it's translated very briefly, and it cuts out a little bit about what Jesus says. Okay? Many commentaries, though, the problem is there's a lot of people writing about it. It's sort of like knowing if you wrote a letter to me and then it disappeared because somebody hid it, but everybody else knew too and were writing about that letter. People were saying, well, where's the letter? Well, clearly it exists because everybody's writing about it, right? So there's a lot of references we have from even hundreds, you know, a couple hundred years after Jesus that mention this passage. The whole passage we even have up through the 400s, Jerome, St. Jerome is a guy you may have seen, and he's kind of important in church history in terms of preserving texts. He mentions it a ton, and he's a very respected scholar, and a lot of people are like, well, what gives? Greek, Latin, everybody's writing about it. Why do you think, just personally, because there is an answer, and we found this out in scholarship eventually, why do you think this particular passage was just kind of pushed aside, like don't think about that too much? What happens in that story that might make you think we don't like that very much? That's one of the reasons it feels like, this is Jesus condoning sin. And not only that, but he must be in on it, right? There's a lot of people that think this goes back to a lot of people like to link him to Mary and all these things and say, well, this is Jesus' lustful side showing, right? There's a lot of weird jumps people made. However, St. Augustine wrote a pretty funny rebuttal to this, saying that after a while, he says, certain persons of little faith or enemies of the true faith, fearing lest their wives should be given to impunity and sinning, remove these from manuscripts that talk about the Lord's act of forgiveness toward the adulteress, as if he had said sin no more, had actually granted us permission to sin. And so a lot of these weak-minded people really were thinking, this is him saying it, we're afraid our spouses are going to think we can do this, right? So there was a lot of early church fathers trying to put this aside, and this is why it was a problem. But the thing, I wanted to mention that because we know it's real, we know it's a gospel, we know the story existed, and it exists where it is in the Bible. And other reasons too. Nothing contradicts the flow of it. Nothing contradicts Jesus here, as many people will say. That's Jesus is acting. He's contradicting the law. No, he's not. You know, you're not reading it. You're reading superficially. It's all the genuine eyewitness account. We see that an overwhelming number of people say this. So getting into it, and I can see why it agitates people, because I don't think people like to forgive very much, right? Kind of don't like that. Right? It doesn't feel good. We want to punish that other person, right? Well, if we go back to John 7, we're going to look at the text here before we discuss a couple of the finer points. If you go back to John 7, because one thing about this, before we kind of look at just what Jesus says, there's a lot of stuff. He doesn't just show up. I kind of think sometimes we say, well, Jesus just happened to show up at this opportune time and made the best of it, right? That's not true. He's in a specific place and time. And there's things going around this that I think this is just one part of a flowing story where Jesus is telling us who he is. John 1 tells us who he is, but that's not the end of it. So if we go to John 7, in verse 1 it says, after these things Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. His brothers therefore said to him, depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples may see the works you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For even his brothers did not believe him. So in that verse, those verses I read, what's happening in Jerusalem? What's the event, and why did his disciples want him to go? Verse 2 there, Feast of Tabernacles. This might have a different translation. That's why I kind of want you all to look at it. Mine says tabernacles. What does yours say? Booths. Anybody else have another one? Anybody have one that says Sukkot or Sukkot? It's the original word. Festival of shelters. Yes. Okay. And his disciples wanted him to go because why? Jesus, go talk about yourself. Why? Why are you hiding? He wants them to show the people what he's doing, right? So when we go forward, his ministry, right, we're down here. I know it's not a huge map, but, you know, we spend a lot of time here in Kings, but we got to remember we're back up here is Mount Carmel and all this, and Jesus is up here at Capernaum, you know, spends a lot of his time up there, and of course his disciples want him to go down to Jerusalem. Jesus has been to Jerusalem many times, so he's got quite a journey to go here, right? Galilee to Judea is quite a ways. Feast of Booths and Tabernacles. We see a couple of things. What is the Feast of Booths? Anybody want to share? There are many more experts in here on feasts than I am, so I'm trying not to derail this on feasts, although it'd be fun. But What is the Feast of Booths? Do y'all remember that? Feast of Tabernacles. What's the main idea? Yeah, that was a big part of it. It reminded them of living that in the wilderness. In verse 6 to 13, we see Jesus tells them, we don't have to read all that, but Jesus says, "My time is not yet come, but your time is always ready." And it goes down, if you scroll down in the chapter there, at about verse 10 onward, it says, after his brothers went, he went anyway. He went in secret, right? So Jesus sends them on, and about 3.5 days later, he shows up at the Feast of the Tabernacles. And this is on purpose. Jesus, his ministry is ramping up, right? He's starting to get really bold, and the time is coming, right? And Jesus is letting it out, right? He is letting, he's saying it, he's saying what he needs to say. He's not shying away. He never shied away. But he's going to be really, really, really pulling some, not pulling punches here when we see that, right? Jesus' time had not yet come, he says, but he goes in secret. What did he mean about my time has not yet come? Was he talking about, what was he talking about?
Dying.
Okay. His the fulfillment, okay? Because some of the translations may say it says, I'm not going, or it says Jesus was lying here. It's not, it's I have not yet, it's not yet come. Because, yeah, he's implying that, his time for fulfillment with his death, and also what's about to happen, not quite time for that. So a couple of quick notes on where we're at when he's about to have this encounter. This is kind of a quick map of the festivals, right? And if you'll notice, they're divided by seasons, right? They tend to kind of go in this chart. That's on purpose. God had these festivals so they could remember and the harvest and how they rely on him. And it's based on a lunar calendar that doesn't quite match with ours. But it's funny because this story with the woman, the adulteress, we're doing it about the right time that it would probably happen. Be honest with you, it happened in the fall. And we know that based on when this festival was. So we're about 2 or 3 weeks removed of when this story would have taken place there. But we had three main feasts, if you remember from the Old Testament, from Exodus. There were three main feasts commanded that the men had to go to, and there were others in between. We had the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which also at Passover, we had this going on, reminding them about the Passover and beginning to leave Egypt in a hurry. The Feast of the Harvest, which we led to Pentecost, right? And then it leads up to the Fall Feast, which is the Feast of Gathering, or Ingathering, or Feast of Tabernacles. Okay, that's what that means. And these were all stages to remind them of their journey, amongst other things. It was a time to harvest. There was the Feast of Trumpets, of Atonement, leading to the Tabernacles. And Jesus shows up now, right? Because now it's time for him to tell everyone there, by the way, this is about me, right? He's fulfilling every prophecy, so he just as he said he would. And that's where we're at over here. Now, if you look in John 7, this is an example of the Feast of, they still do this, right? This is like a current one from like last year. I got a picture that they've got the citrons, and so Jewish folks will still do this. I had a picture of somebody in an apartment. They had built a little tent in their apartment. Like, they still celebrate this outside. They go outside and camp for 7 days, right? And they did this in these little huts, right? They'd use certain types of trees that the Old Testament said, willow, things like that, citrons. And they were to camp out, basically. Kids probably love it, right? But they would live out in these things, and they do that for 7 days, okay? And you've kind of mentioned what this is about. It was called the Feast of Sukkot. Sukkah means tent or tabernacle. Sukkot is Hebrew plural for that. So it's talking about the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tents, the Feast of Shelters, right? Temporary structures. And we won't have time to necessarily read all that, but this is all found in Leviticus 23. So feel free to read all that on your own. But Leviticus 23:33-44 tells us all about that. God tells them what to build, how to build it, when to go in them, when to come out. Remember your wandering in the wilderness. Deuteronomy 16 refers to also, you're going to have this time of harvest. You're going to give to me your best. You're going to remember, I provide, right? That's a theme here. And Jesus is trying to tell them that. Because what did this ultimately have to do with Jesus about the idea of a tabernacle? What do you think? What does that tabernacle have to do with Jesus?
In John, when the word that says the word became flesh and dwelt among us, the word is, I believe, the same word for tabernacle.
Next slide. Yep. You got it. That's it. Some of you may have a translation, and for time's sake, if you do, please, you can look that up and let me know. But John 1:14 says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And the word used here in many translations, it's from the Greek tabernacled. He tabernacled with us, right? It's on the nose. And Jesus is trying to use this to teach these people, right? He's showing, by the way, that's me, about a temporary dwelling. You know, the Bible talks about our bodies as temples. Jesus is temporarily here on earth, and he's going to, you know, it talks about all these themes to tell everyone that I'm the one you've been waiting on, leading to a permanent home. 2 Corinthians 5, I don't think we have time to read that. I want to get to the text here, but I want you to think about some of these things about Jesus where it literally talks about him being a tabernacle. Jesus would claim to be the light of the world, the source of living water in John 8:12. The pool of Siloam, somebody mentioned that earlier in John 7. Before he has his encounter, he talks about, I'm the living water and the light of the world. Also at the Feast of Tabernacles, they would have four big candelabras lit up, right? And so when that happened, he was telling them, by the way, I'm that light. Pool of Siloam happens. The priests would go up and bring the water. And just a couple of things here I just wanted to mention. Pool of Siloam, you've probably seen this mentioned in other texts, but we go back to Hezekiah back in 2 Kings where they built a tunnel, which they excavated and ran all the way from Mount Gihon to Jerusalem. So we had this all set up centuries ago where the pool was fed. The city would have water. We know all this. We know it dates back to Herod. Adam showed us a big second temple building, which this would be Jesus' building that we see here when he goes to the temple. We know that Herod built it, just a little history there, where we have it built up, and we know that it's the same pool used in the Feast of Tabernacles. A lot we could talk about there, but I want us to kind of focus on how Jesus is in this final feast, and that's when he acts in the end of chapter 7. Just a screen, kind of a model of the second temple. We have the Watergate, which is where this would have happened on the side, not the Nixon thing, but Watergate. We have it coming up the side here, where we would have, you know, the priest would come down, take the vessel, go dip the water of the pool, come back up through and go to the altar and pour it out of a golden vessel into a silver vessel, which would flow on the altar. And that's when Jesus stands up on the eighth day and says, I'm the living water. That's me, right? That's what he's saying. And it's at that point where he makes a scene. He says, this is me. And everyone now knows where he's at. And then he goes to the temple, sits down. And that's when the scribes and Pharisees show up. And I'll skip past this for now. just some other verses you can look at where he talks about his kinghood. We also see him, he never says, I'm the King of Kings outright in this chapter, but he says, I'm the King of Kings because I'm the one you're anointing, right? That's what that water is, that oil. So looking at John 8, I want us to look at that passage we just read. You notice in John 8, especially verses 3 to 5, you see the scribes and Pharisees take a chance to test him openly, I believe is what the verse says. What are two ways they were hoping to entrap Jesus here? So what are the two big ways? If you can maybe think ahead or think about what is it they're trying to do. There's one of two ways they can catch him. What are they?
They want him to go against the law.
Which law?
The Old Testament.
Say the Mosaic law, Old Testament law. How could he go against Old Testament law?
Sabbath.
Okay, there's the Sabbath, but there's more in this. What's that?
To not stoner.
Okay, so if he says not to stoner, he's violating the law because what did the law say about adulterers? Do you remember? What? Both of them? That doesn't sound very good. I must be mishearing. That's these people, right? Awful convenient. That's why I put this up here. I want to remember, this story is not about the adulterous woman. It's about the adulterous woman and the hypocritical men. And, right? Yes, she sinned. So did they, okay? And this is what happens again while Jesus shows us, I think, another lesson of what being masculine is in this with this woman, how he treats her, and how these other men definitely are not, right? But we see, what are two ways hoping and trapping? Well, they've got two, right? In Romans 18, we see a reference. We don't have to go there right now, but this verse tells us that, you know, you can't have any death penalties without Rome sanctioning them, right? So he's going to break Roman law if he actually goes through with it. They're going to run to the Romans and say, hey, he just killed a guy. Got him, right? They're setting him up. It's disingenuous. If Jesus says killer, they're going to take him to the authorities. Now, Leviticus 20:10, going back to that, somebody want to read that real quick for me? Leviticus 20:10, read that verse for me if you don't mind.
If a man commits adultery with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death.
Okay, and that parallels another verse where we've got up here too in a minute, the man and the woman must be brought, okay? Those are some of the parties. In John 8:6, What is it then he does? Somebody tell me. John 8, verse 6. After they tell him that, what does Jesus do? John 8, 6. I'm sorry. Here comes the wrote on the ground verse, right? He goes right down. He bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. And then he tells them, you know, who's without sin, be the first to throw a stone. Then he wrote on the ground again. What did he write? And this is where I'll throw it out. You know, you're not going to get it solved tonight, but I'm going to give you what I think. So sorry if that's what you wanted. But I will say I think we do know more than we act like we do. What do y'all think? I think everybody's read something about this or have a feeling about it. And I think there's different ways to take it. But based on the text, what is it you've always thought? What do you envision?
Tic-tac-toe.
Okay, tic-tac-toe. That's the first one I've heard, but you know, I like that one.
Accusers.
Accusatory writing. Could be. Speculation. I'm not trying to write the Gospel of Michael here, but speculation. But accusatory writing? What else?
I think he would just doodle and giving them time to think.
Could have been. I think there's something there. I think even if he was doodling, the purpose was pushing a thought process, right? But I will say there's evidence for a couple of things if you look at it, the grammar and stuff. So looking at this a little bit in the time we have, when he gets down, it affects the accusers. In verse 6 and 7, he agitates. So they get agitated, right? He just writes. They push and push and push. And then Jesus doesn't volunteer it. In Deuteronomy 16, 18, that verse tells us who can actually adjudicate these instances. And it's a judge, right? It tells, if you go back to Deuteronomy 16, it says a judge will adjudicate these matters. So a couple of things here. The Pharisees and scribes, we already know, they've, like in John 20, they think he's got a demon in him. They think he's crazy. They don't like Jesus. So they've already said Jesus is bad. But now you want to come to me, Jesus says, and you want me to be a judge. So am I a judge now? I'm authority. Good, I'm in, right? There's no way they can answer this, that they come out on top, right? And also that word, I do think this is interesting. I think if you look closely, the word used is catagrapheo, which means to write against or to write or engrave. And there's a few ways to take that. I've seen it translated as accusatory writing. I kind of tend to lean that way. There is another word for just writing, just kind of saying stuff. But it does seem to use a couple of times this idea of writing against or writing a record. So maybe he was writing against. I don't know. But there's a lot there we could say. We do see it referenced in Job. I will say, if you want to do some homework and read Job 13, 26 and Job 31, 35. Those, if you look at the Greek and the Old Hebrew, use words that we don't have time to go into, but they translate from essentially writing against. And the word the Greeks used for translating Hebrew in the Septuagint was the same word that means that they use in John. So, I don't know. There's a lot we could think about, but there's definitely Jesus writing something to draw their attention, okay? So, kind of more of a rhetorical question, but you know, he says, let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone. So Romans 3:23 says we've all sinned and are guilty, right? So is Jesus crazy here? What's he mean? How can someone be without sin? What's he saying? Because I think that's what this comes down to. Jesus turns this into a legalese matter. Because if you want to get legalism, we can do that. Because now we see him saying, who's supposed to cast the first stone? The witnesses are supposed to cast the first stone. Are you the witness? Why were you there? Which one are you? Were you in bed with her? See, there's no way to get out of this, right? There's no way to win. So if the men who brought this woman forward, right, they should cast the first stone, Jesus said, according to Mosaic law. Because if you're the witness, the law says you do it. Why are you asking me to do it? Are you not followers of the law? Are you breaking the law? Should I tell somebody? Right? See, he's got them. And so there's nothing they can do. And he flips it back on them in a way where he traps them in their own snare. And this is why this story, he turns it and says, you know, you want justice and law, but you have a problem here. Because like you said earlier, we come back to if a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both must die. Whoops. So that's a problem because there's no man here, right? There's no man that's been brought forward. So how did these accusers demonstrate by doing this? How is that admitting they're not guiltless there? Yeah, nobody threw a rock, right? The omission of it, right? I want us to think about that because I think we can answer that. We know the woman committed adultery, okay? They only brought one. They were silent about it because the consequences, maybe they're hiding somebody. I don't know. But Jesus doesn't flinch, right? He gets right down. He looks back up. Are they still there? No? Nope. Where are they at, right? And so there's an omission there. And in John 8, 9, we see that they couldn't make a choice provided, okay? And I'll try to wrap here. I want you to think about what we see in Matthew 7 as I kind of get to the end here. If you read verses 1 to 5, we see Matthew talk about what judgment you judge, you will be judged. They were duplicitous, right? And I think the idea here is right. You know, when we have these passages in the Bible about rebuking and paying attention to yourselves, it comes back to this particular passage, like Ronnie said, is more about a sentence, right? He's not going to engage in this law sentencing, right? He's talking about mercy. He's talking about moving forward. Because this tale is important. As it closes, he says, has no one condemned you? And she says, no one, right? So he says, I want you to remember this as we close. He doesn't say, I forgive you, does he? What does he say? Neither do I condemn you, sin no more. And I think that's what we come back to, because if he says, I forgive you, honestly, this woman could say, what does that mean? What does that get me? But what he can do is say, and when he dies, obviously Christ is going to, there's a new way coming, right? What I'm focused on is where we go. And the Pharisees were focused on looking backward, right? He's looking, so I'm a fulfillment of this. By the way, I am the king, and I'm saying, stop it. That means I know you sinned, but don't do it anymore, right? And that's what I think we want to focus on. So thank you all for your time. We'll see you next week.